the picturesque buildings of an antiquated township. BBC, number 13. Greg Wise, Paul Freeman, David Burke, Tom Burke. A horse-drawn coach pulls up outside the Golden Lion Hotel and a porter comes out to greet its passenger. The passenger's a 40-something man with a moustache. He looks well-to-do, wearing smart clothing of the early 1900s. He walks into the hotel carrying a briefcase while his luggage is offloaded from the coach. Directed by Pierre Wilkie. At the reception desk.
Anderson, you say?
Professor Anderson.
Oh, yes, here it is. I've put you on the top floor. Nice views of the cathedral up there. You stayed here before, sir?
No, I'm afraid I haven't had that pleasure.
Oh, one of the oldest buildings in the town is this. I could tell you a bit about the history if you like.
Yes, well, perhaps once I've settled in.
Right. Well, let's take you up then.
The landlord, Gunton, leads the way to the room while Professor Anderson's heavy suitcase is hauled upstairs with difficulty by the porter. As they head up a narrow staircase, Anderson suddenly stops.
No, no, I'm sorry, this is no good. Too many steps. Weak knees, I'm afraid. Perhaps one on a lower floor.
Gunton shows Anderson another room.
This one to your liking, sir.
No, not unless there's a desk hiding somewhere.
Exasperated, Gunton throws his hands up a little as Anderson strides back out into the hall. At the door to yet another room.
You won't get the same views.
I'm not interested in views. I simply require somewhere to sleep and work. What about this one? Number 12.
The landlord opens the door and Anderson walks in to inspect the room. He finds a desk in front of the window.
See now? This is perfect.
The porter drags the suitcase into the corner of the wood-panelled room.
Will you be taking supper tonight, Mr. Anderson?
Suppose so. Dare say it's the safest prospect.
Anderson goes to look out of a second window. Having manhandled the suitcase onto a small table, the porter is ushered out by Gunton, who clasps his hands together, slightly awkwardly, as he approaches the new guest.
Sir, could I ask if you wouldn't mind settling the bill for your stay in advance?
Really? I don't know. It's most unusual.
I understand, sir. But you see, the problem is, from time to time, we've had guests disappear without paying.
Surely not respectable guests.
Oh, I'm afraid so, sir. There was a Mr. Entwistle. He was a college man, just like yourself. Seemed a nice enough gent. Then, poof, gone one night without settling his bill.
Well, I'm sure I don't intend to disappear.
He hands over a piece of paper, which Gunton accepts.
Much obliged, sir.
With the landlord gone, Anderson goes about settling into the room. He places two leather-bound books on a shelf beneath a porcelain water bowl and smooths down his moustache when he catches sight of himself in the mirror. He places a small silver case in a drawer, then fetches more books from his briefcase and arranges them on the desk. Finally, still carrying the briefcase, he picks up his coat and walking stick and heads for the door. Just as he's about to go out, Anderson stops to make an alteration to the order of the books on the desk. Satisfied, he leaves the room. Now, Anderson's outside walking past a stone wall. He goes through a doorway and turns right, heading down an alley. Arriving at an impressive cathedral, he strides beneath a series of the building's arches before entering an alcove where he's given directions by a man he meets there. Later, he's admiring the books in a small library.
This is quite a hoard.
Some of these manuscripts date from the 8th century. Things were in rather a jumble. A Cambridge man helped us for a short while. We are gradually imposing some order.
Making discoveries, it seems.
The older man, Harrington, moves closer.
Well, that's for you to judge.
So, where exactly did these turn up?
They were found hidden in a hole in the wall, would you believe?
Extraordinary.
From a pile of yellowed letters and manuscripts to the cathedral beneath overcast skies at dusk. Anderson's wearing his reading glasses, studying something intently when he removes them and rubs his nose wearily.
Have you found anything significant?
No, usual stuff. Objections to the prayer book, painted glass, popish ornaments. Although the complaints against the Bishop Walgrave seem a little, unusual.
Really?
They get quite worked up about his house. Curious lights, unnatural cries, a stranger who comes and goes in the night time. Surprised I've not come across any record of him before.
He does seem a rather unpopular bishop.
Anderson dons his spectacles again and resumes his reading. Later, showing signs of tiredness once more, he stands up and stretches a little. He's alone in the library now, and sighing heavily, his attention is drawn to an empty section of shelf on the wall. He leans down to look behind the gap. Seeing something there, he reaches in and pulls out an old, faded letter. He sees a coat of arms emblem on one side of the letter and an unbroken wax seal on the other. After the slightest of hesitations, he breaks it open. Opening the document out, he finds another coat of arms above some intricate writing, some oddly shaped markings, and a signature.
Nicholas Franken.
Harrington returns, and Anderson stuffs the letter back where he found it.
I'm afraid I have to close up for the night.
Back at the hotel, Anderson's buttoning up the shirt cuffs of his evening attire in front of a roaring fire. Doing up his white waistcoat, he walks over to examine a picture on the opposite wall. It's a panel from Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights, depicting dozens of nude people frolicking sinfully in a lush green field. Out in the hall, Anderson walks past another picture and stops to straighten it when a man, also wearing an evening suit, emerges from a room.
Oh, you must be my neighbour.
Going down to dinner?
Yes.
Not many guests.
I really have no idea.
Edward Jenkins. Can be a bit dull this time of year. Expect we'll all be dining together.
Marvellous.
Next, a candle-lit dinner table. Three well-dressed women dine with Anderson, Jenkins, and another man. They're all eating soup, and Anderson looks up at the loudly slurping Jenkins sitting opposite him. The woman looks slightly uncomfortable as Jenkins puts his spoon down to take a gulp from his wine glass. To Anderson.
Here on business, then.
A scholarly matter.
Cambridge man. My firm does a lot of work with your lot. Colleges, dons. Dare say you've heard of us.
I doubt it. I'm from Oxford.
Oh.
The cathedral archivist has turned up some documents from the Cromwellian era. I'm here to authenticate.
Roundheads.
I'm considered to be rather an authority.
I'm sure. If you ask me, those Puritans were a grim lot, dressed all in black, telling everyone what they can and can't do. I'd sooner have been a cavalier, me. Far more fun.
The two younger women find this amusing. Later, Jenkins and Anderson are at the foot of the stairs.
Well, that's that then. Fancy a cigar in the lounge?
Not for me. Thank you. Good night.
Now, as Anderson sleeps, the writing on the letter drifts through his slumbering thoughts.
Nicholas Franken.
A detail on the coat of arms, two crossed bones, then the seal being broken, and some nude figures from the painting. Some of the painted characters are eating fruit, while others swim or romp together. Anderson turns his head restlessly. Awakening, he sits up in bed and looks across the dark room. The laughter seems to be coming from behind one particular wall.
Jenkins.
Anderson gets up and walks to the wall. Wearily, he climbs back into bed and curls up again, falling asleep almost instantly. Suddenly, an eerie glow illuminates the Bosch painting, and a shadow, a still human figure, appears beside it. Anderson sleeps on, and slowly, the light and the shadow dissolve and disappear. Morning, and Anderson blinks as he wakes from his sleep. He throws the bedsheets aside and slowly gets to his feet, crossing the room in his nightshirt. He stops briefly to look at the Bosch painting before delving into his open suitcase. Later, dressed, he nods to some hotel guests as he comes down the stairs.
Good morning.
He looks at a blackboard displaying the room numbers.
You're missing 13. Never mind.
He leaves the porter to his duties. Later, Anderson arrives at the cathedral library. He goes to the gap in the shelves again, and throwing a furtive glance at the door, he puts down his briefcase and cane and reaches his hand into the gap. He seems unable to locate the letter. He pokes his head into the gap to see better, just as Harrington enters the library and approaches Anderson from behind.
Still interested in the bishop?
Yes. Do you think he might be mentioned anywhere else in the archive?
You never know.
And how about Nicholas Franken? You don't recognize the name?
Can't say I do. Who is it?
Not sure. Yet.
Another mystery.
Anderson steps over to a table and removes his jacket.
I must say you're a superstitious lot round here. I thought things might have improved since Cromwell's time.
What makes you say that?
My hotel doesn't list a room number 13, for one.
Ah, yes. Yours won't be the only establishment not to have an unlucky number 13.
Remarkable. So if you could point me in the direction of the diocese records, I'll see if I can track down your much maligned bishop and his house of ill repute.
Harrington walks from the library, his hands behind his back. Anderson follows. Later, Anderson's turning a page in a heavy old tome. He closes the book and is soon fetching another, smaller volume from a shelf. By the light of two candles, Anderson rigorously explores the contents of the library. He opens folded documents and studies book after book. Eventually, Harrington rejoins him.
Ah.
Found something?
In the most surprising of places. A record of the 1647 witch trials, testimony of an Anne Mundy. Aside from confessing to the drowning of children and the suckling of a giant rat, she claims to have been taken to a local house to go before the devil's emissary, the foreign man, she calls him, where he did conjure evil spirits and bade me make covenant with the devil.
Amazing what these poor wretches will say under torture.
As I agree, the house in question belonged to the bishop.
Extraordinary.
I've been looking to see if she puts a name to this devil's emissary.
Putting some books down, Harrington looks over at Anderson for a moment. Anderson's staring down at a name he's found written in the manuscript, Nicholas Franken. He removes his glasses. Later, he's about to climb the staircase at the hotel.
Thank you.
Anderson finds one of the female guests, a red-haired young woman, in the sitting room.
Hello.
Seeing that she's sitting with Jenkins, Anderson suddenly looks awkward and walks away.
Anyway, it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life.
Really?
Jenkins is holding the young lady's knitting wool. Reading a newspaper on the other side of the room, Anderson watches as the two chat to each other. Jenkins reaches over to touch the lady's earring.
What about this? Is
that it? Anderson makes clear his disapproval in the loud manner he folds the newspaper and leaves the room. Jenkins smiles. Now, in his darkened room, Anderson wears a dressing gown as he dries his hands with a towel. Finding his suitcase gone, he looks around in confusion. Finally, confusion gives way to annoyance, and he removes his dressing gown and throws it aside. Later, Anderson's bed is surrounded by soft drapings that become illuminated by an unnatural light. The material seems imbued with shapes and colours from the Bosch painting, and Anderson stirs restlessly within. The drapes flutter slightly in a draft, causing a rippling effect across the image of a painted man accepting a berry from a large bird. Behind the drapes, the face of the red-haired young woman appears. It's the woman from the sitting room. She gazes at Anderson intently before leaning over his sleeping form. Slowly, she places a hand on his shoulder. Anderson opens his eyes. He sits up suddenly and stares about the dimly lit room. But there's no one there. Looking shocked, he tries to locate the source of the laughter and gets up to go to the wall again. He steps back towards the bed. Anderson stands with his mouth open as he listens to the new sounds. He puts on his dressing gown and peeks out into the hall. There's no one there, but he sees a flickering light emanating from beneath the next room's door. He lights a match and sees that the room number is 13. In his own room, the ghostly shadow appears next to the painting again. Anderson's listening at the door. The shadow moves across the painting, the profile of a man. Still holding the lit match, Anderson prepares to turn the door handle. He moves aside and presses his back to the wall as a drunk-looking Jenkins appears and approaches the door. Unaware of Anderson, Jenkins lets himself into the room. Anderson breathes a sigh of relief and heads back to his own room. He awakes the next morning when the porter comes in carrying the porcelain bowl and a towel.
I want to have a word with you. What have you done with my portmanteau? My case? The large square piece of luggage you carried up?
The porter gestures to the other side of the room where the case rests in its original place. Anderson gets up and goes over to it, looking perplexed. The porter stares at him.
I didn't see you bring it back in.
As the porter leaves the room, Anderson examines the contents of the case, still a little baffled. Now he's dressed and locking up his door before heading down the hallway. He pauses when he sees the number on the room next to his. 14. He walks back down the hall and checks the numbers on his own room and the one next to it. 12 and 11. He returns to room 14, and after staring at the wooden number plate for a moment, he begins to tug at it to see if it will come loose. Suddenly, the door opens.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I thought it was a different room.
Wait, you didn't think it was...
The bleary-eyed Jenkins returns to his room. Now, Anderson is eating breakfast in the dining room when two of the female guests appear. They help themselves to some food laid out on a table near the door, then join Anderson at the dining table. The woman sitting closest to Anderson is the red-haired one. He seems very uneasy. He puts his cutlery down on his plate, dabs his mouth with a napkin, and leaves the table. Later, Anderson's setting off outside when he comes across Harrington.
Mr. Harrington.
I was on my way to see you.
Good. Because I think we need to talk about what exactly was sealed up in that wall. The parchment signed by Nicholas Franken? The one I found and put back. The one that went missing the very next day.
I really have no idea what you're talking about.
It would be a shame if I had to go to the Dean.
I was talking to the Dean last night. He's a little concerned about where your inquiries are heading. I'm sure you are a serious scholar, Mr. Anderson, no axe to grind against the church. But we do think it wise to know exactly what's in our archive before we open it to prying eyes.
Are you telling me to stay away?
For the time being.
For heaven's sake, man, this is ludicrous. I'm an historian. I'm not trying to prove the bishop really was in league with some fiend. Surely you don't believe that.
What I believe is not the point. This is largely a rural community, Mr. Anderson. As you know, superstition is rife. Half of our flock still swear by the black shuck and jack-o'-lantern. The last thing they need is the rumor of a witch house in the town.
You mean the bishop's house still exists?
Go back to your dreaming spires, Professor. Leave the church to deal with its own nightmares.
Harrington goes, leaving Anderson looking intrigued. He walks on.
The bishop's house still exists.
Prayed it comes from evil spirits, and bade me make a covenant with the devil. Supposing what these poor wretches will say under torture.
This is largely a rural community, Mr. Anderson. Half of our flock still swear by the black shuck, jack-o'-lantern.
Anderson pauses when he sees a group of local men and women standing around a fire in a brazier. They look at him with suspicion. Now, Anderson's at the hotel again. He approaches Gunton, who's hunched over a book he's writing in by candlelight.
Be wanting some supper?
No, I'm not hungry.
Gunton returns to his scribblings. He's copying something from a piece of paper into the book.
It's quiet tonight. No Miss Goddard and her mother.
Checked out this afternoon.
What about Jenkins, the lawyer fellow?
Feeling unwell. Can I get you a drink, sir?
No. You know, what I'd like is to hear some of your local history. You offered to tell me when I first arrived.
I am rather busy, sir.
I am very, very interested.
Well, I really only know a few bits and pieces. Like... There was a house on this site mentioned in the Doomsday Book.
Was there? That's fascinating.
Oh, yes. It was in the hands of the Walgrave family for generations. Changed hands a number of times in the last 200 years or so. Let me see, there was...
Wait a minute. Walgrave family? That's not Bishop Walgrave, is it?
Yes, that's right. The Parliament men... threw him in the tower, then they stormed this place looking for some foreigner who he'd been harbouring. Frankham, that was his name. And the story goes that he vanished into thin air when they fired at him.
Look, why don't you call up to my room once you've finished your accounts? I can make a few notes then.
Gliding over the surface of the Bosch painting, nude figures astride enormous cat-like creatures, and many more dipping in the shallow waters of a pool. Anderson's in his room, and he goes to the door to investigate the sounds emanating from outside. He looks out into the hall, where he sees a chair being dragged along. He sighs with relief. Perturbed, Anderson walks around the room, searching for the source of the laughter. He places his ear near the painting and listens.
I confess to the sin of witchcraft and of murder in the form of drowning of several children.
Anderson moves along the wall, still listening.
It was under the demon's spell that I did suckle a giant rat unto my breast for to give succour to this wretched man. For it was he, Nicholas Franken, who bade the devil rise.
The shadow of a man stands unseen against the wall as Anderson clutches at his ears. Anderson removes his hands from his head, then looks over at the wall, where he sees the ghostly shadow. The shadow turns slowly till the man's head is in profile. Anderson's both terrified and fascinated. He backs away, watching as the shadow slides across the wall, passing the painting and moving, apparently, ever closer. Anderson crashes against the corner of the bed, unable to take his eyes from the apparition and its slow, steady progress towards him. His wide eyes look over to the door as it opens, and Gunton enters the room.
I brought us a little nightcap.
Is anything the matter?
Do you think it's funny, do you?
Mr. Anderson?
Playing tricks on outsiders. Scaring them half to death with your idiot shadows.
I thought you wanted to know about the hotel.
The only thing I want to know about is room 13.
Mr. Anderson, please!
I've seen it. I know it's there. I just don't know how you do it.
You're overtired. Perhaps a good night's sleep, eh?
Well, that would be a fine thing. It's the staff, isn't it? I suppose they found out about my work, about Nicholas Franken. You know they creep in here to rearrange my things.
Oh, I don't think so, sir.
Then you tell me where my portmanteau's gone. It's not the first time. Oh, it's that porter. He's a surly fellow. Is he the one in number 13?
Mr. Anderson, for the last time, there is no number 13.
You heard it. Sometimes it's like there's hundreds of them in there.
It must be Mr. Jenkins. He's drunk again.
Mad, more like.
Gentlemen, please. This noise. Drink, by all means, but let me sleep. Let me sleep.
The words seem to come from the wall. Anderson and Gunton turn to stare at Jenkins. Shortly, all three men are stepping cautiously down the hallway. Arriving at the neighbouring room, they look down at the flickering light coming from beneath the door.
I see it, but I can still hardly believe it.
Anderson tries to open the door, but it won't budge. The three men start pushing against it, but to no avail.
Mr. Gunton, fetch your man to break it down.
Gunton goes.
I noticed this room before, but I always put it down to the brandy. I got a bit carried away sometimes.
I'm not surprised. It's the only way to get any sleep here. I thought I was seeing things, or that someone was playing an elaborate practical joke.
Maybe they are.
found the perfect pair to make asses of.
Suddenly, the door opens, revealing only blackness beyond. Anderson and Jenkins stare into the room as a dim, intermittent light appears. It illuminates something, or someone, indistinct and distant. Anderson holds an arm up and, slowly, reaches into the room. The flickering sliver of light moves closer. Suddenly, a black-gloved hand reaches through the door and grabs Anderson's wrist. Jenkins struggles to pull Anderson from the room.
Help me!
Anderson collapses in the hall and the door slams shut. Gunton.
What's happened?
The thing in 13 tried to snatch him.
Thomas. No!
The porter begins hacking at the door with an axe, but the door's no longer there.
The door.
The porter pulls the blade from the wood-paneled wall. Gunton feels the surface with his hand. Bewildered, they all look at each other. Anderson still clutching his wrist as he listens to the clock's chimes. Now it's morning, and Anderson wakes with a start as something touches his neck.
Jenkins, your foot.
My apologies. What time is it? I've slept the sleep of the dead.
You were quite alive. I could tell by your snoring. You know, this is the room the landlord originally offered me.
Imagine if you'd taken it. All the excitement you'd have missed.
Anderson considers this. Next, both men are walking along the hall.
You must be taking up the floorboards.
Gunton's determined to find a trace of number 13. Don't look so glum. Might be good for business, having a ghost room.
What is it? What have you found?
Anderson reads a label on some torn rags held up by a disturbed-looking Gunton.
G. Entwistle.
The Cambridge man. The one I thought had gone without paying.
Anderson looks at the rags again, then he hands them back to Gunton and steps past him into his old room. The porter is standing by the painting. Some floorboards have been hauled up and are leaning against the wall next to him. Jenkins joins Anderson as he crouches by the gap in the floor. Anderson reaches between the exposed floor beams and picks up a dusty pair of spectacles. Jenkins brushes away the grime from a metal flask. Anderson then shakes a thick layer of dust from a letter bearing the same coat of arms as on the Nicholas Franken letter. This letter also has a wax seal. Something seems to dawn on him as he stares at it. Somewhat fearfully, he tosses it back into the hole. He stands up and looks down at the collection of clothing and personal items lying between the exposed floor beams.